This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 26, 2004. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. The U.S. vetoes the U.N. Security Council's resolution that condemned Israel's assassination of Hamas leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Mitch Jezerich takes a look at fundraising in both the Bush and Kerry campaigns. And the U.S. Senate has approved legislation whose language calls a fetus a person from the point of conception. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Republican congressional leaders want to declassify Richard Clark's testimony to the September 11th commission given behind closed doors in 2002. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist says he wants to know if Clark lied under oath. In his best-selling book, and again at a public hearing this week, Clark charged that high-level Bush administration officials ignored or reduced the priority of key warnings the intelligence community had about an impending dramatic attack. And National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice is requesting a private meeting with the September 11th Commission, saying she wants to offer her version of what Rice calls mischaracterizations she heard during this week's hearings. A few commissioners criticized and at times poked fun at Rice, who has to date refused to testify publicly, citing separation of powers. This week's economic figures show that corporate profits in 2003 hit double digits, while personal income barely rose one-half of 1%. Ingrid Drake reports from D.C.
The U.S. Commerce Department announced corporate profits went up 19.2% in 2003. Meanwhile, the income of people rose a mere 0.4%. Last year was the first time since the late 90s U.S. companies enjoyed double-digit annual profits 2 years in a row. Chris Hartman from the Boston-based group United for a Fair Economy says since 2001, corporate growth gains have been going to shareholders, not wages. It is unclear how the Federal Reserve will respond during an election year. Hartman says there is a question of the neutrality of Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan.
When Clinton was president, he said the most important thing was to reduce the deficit. And then Bush comes in and he says tax cuts are the most important thing and deficits aren't so bad.
Officials from the Federal Reserve have joined those from the Treasury Department to say they are hopeful new jobs are being created. I'm Ingrid Drake for Free Speech Radio News.
Labor unions in Italy say more than two-thirds of private and government workers went on strike this morning. In Brescia, Deletta Varlese reports.
The general call for a national strike in Italy today was organized by the three main national trade unions that represent all public and private worker sectors. Representing one of the unions from Bologna, this worker explains why they believe the strike is necessary.
This is a strike against the economic policy of this government. This economic policy is creating disasters and everyone's eyes can see them. Attack on salaries, attacks on retirement contributions, attacks on the public education system.
From the hours of 8:30 a.m. to 12 noon local time, protesters focused on the economic policy of the Berlusconi government that is raising insecurity, destabilizing working conditions, reducing the possibility of stable work contracts, increasing the retirement age, while ignoring the collapse of industry. According with a trade union statement, 70% of all workers participate in today's strike. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Diletta Varlese from Brescia, Italy.
Cyprus will be the subject of United Nations-sponsored peace talks seeking to curb the nationally split island from a greater dilemma when Greece becomes a member of the European Union while Turkey must wait. Ezgi Sirtas reports from Ankara.
Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus President Rauf Denktaş will boycott the meetings. He says they will not produce a solution. Prime Minister Mehmet Ali Talat will attend the meetings in his place. The U.S. Foreign Ministry declared that they expect the parties to reach a solution after the talks. The Cyprus problem has to be resolved by May 1st, when Greek Cyprus will join the European Union. The Turkish side will be left out. That will put Turkey in the position of occupying European territory. UN General Secretary Kofi Annan is expected to submit a final plan for the Cyprus problem on Sunday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sertaş from Ankara, Turkey.
U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is looking to temporarily step down if he is indicted on charges of violating Texas's campaign finance laws. At KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
The threat of delays indictment comes from a Texas investigation into alleged use of corporate contributions to finance election campaigns of state GOP lawmakers. Delay founded Texans for a Republican Majority, a group accused of funneling money to lawmakers that backed congressional redistricting here. Texas Observer editor Jake Bernstein has been following the investigation. He says threat of indictment could disrupt Republican unity.
A lot of people have thought that it's all about getting Delay enough people, enough sort of partisans behind him so that he can become a Speaker of the House. And it seems to be going in the opposite direction.
Delay has told supporters he may need to raise more money for a legal defense fund. I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
As reported in the headlines, Republican House Majority Leader Tom Delay may have to temporarily step down from his leadership post if he is indicted by a Texas grand jury that is investigating potential campaign finance abuses. This comes as both Democratic and Republican parties are raising millions of dollars for their presidential candidates and other contenders for the Senate and House of Representatives. As Mitch Jeserich reports, regardless of which party gains control of the government, it is corporations that will ultimately win.
Republican House Majority Leader Tom Delay of Texas has three separate charges filed against him for violating campaign finance laws, and one of the charges could force him from the leadership. A Texas grand jury will decide whether to indict Delay over a political action team he founded that allegedly spent corporate money on the 2002 state House races, violating Texas law. Under Republican House rules, Delay would have to temporarily step down from the leadership if he is indicted. And the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call reported Delay has already begun speaking to other Republicans on the possibility of taking his place. Two ethics groups, Democracy 21 and Common Cause, have also filed complaints against Delay, charging the Republican leader with using a children's charity group he founded to illegally funnel money to the Republican National Convention. Mary Boyle is with Common Cause.
He has a long record of you know, being a foster parent and helping abused and neglected children, and we have obviously no problem with that. What we do have a problem with is using a tax-exempt charity for his own political purposes and to finance his basically political activities at the Republican convention.
Delay's lawyers responded by calling both Democracy 21 and Common Cause partisan left organizations acting as the frontmen for the Democratic Party. Doyle says Common Cause sent letters asking for a congressional inquiry to all the members in the House. She said no member has responded. Meanwhile, congressional members are busy fundraising for their reelection campaign. And on Thursday night, the Democratic Party held a unity dinner where it raised $11 million for Senator John Kerry's presidential campaign. Kerry on Friday rolled out a part of his economic plan to create 10 million jobs by offering tax breaks to corporations to stop outsourcing jobs.
We need a new economic policy that puts an end to wasteful tax cuts for the wealthy and offers new incentives for manufacturing companies to create and keep good jobs here in the United States of America.
The unity dinner also featured former Presidents Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, where Clinton took a jab at the Bush administration.
These people talk about how disciplined they are. Why, when we were there, Gore and I, we let people drink coffee out of styrofoam. They drink China cups. When we were there, we let our kids come to work on the weekends and late at night in jeans and flannel shirts. They always got white shirt and ties. They're the mature party. They're the daddy party. They remind me of teenagers that got their inheritance too soon and couldn't wait to blow it.
Kerry's campaign has received over $40 million, which is the best ever for a Democrat at this stage, but still far behind President Bush's $170 million raised so far. At a $2,000 a plate fundraiser in Kerry's backyard of Boston, Bush touted his economic plan, though weak on jobs, as being strong in other areas.
Manufacturing activity is increasing. Business investment is rising. Disposable income is rising. Inflation is low. Home ownership is at the highest rate ever.
Free Speech Radio News spoke with Larry Noble, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, on campaign finances in the 2004 elections.
You see many of the same industries, many of the same business sectors giving to both candidates. And that's because in many respects, businesses are very pragmatic. They want to give to whoever is going to win. But you see them giving in far greater amounts to President Bush than you see them giving to John Kerry. if you look at the Bush administration, it's been heavily supported by the energy industry, the oil industry, and business in general. And it is a very, very pro-business administration.
Now looking at the other side with Senator John Kerry, what's anything peculiar about what we see in John Kerry's camp?
He does get a lot of his money from the same places that the Republicans get their money. He gets money from business interests, and he's already today talking about proposing tax cuts for businesses that stay in the United States.
Of course, Ralph Nader's candidacy is very controversial, but his point of both parties seeming to have been corporatized seems to ring true.
Yes. I mean, look, it is true that we are dealing in a relatively confined campaign finance system. You know, one could say about Ralph Nader that he gets a lot of his money from trial lawyers. So in one sense, he gets a lot of his money from one of the same sectors that supports Senator Kerry. Again, they all need money from somewhere, and you have to go to the people who have the money.
That was Larry Noble with the Center for Responsive Politics, and I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
After a five-year battle, the Senate yesterday passed a bill dubbed the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. Its approval makes it illegal to harm a fetus during the commission of a federal crime. Congress has sent the legislation to George Bush, who says he will sign it into law. Pro-choice advocates are worried that the bill recognizes that a fetus, from the point of conception, is a person. California Senator Dianne Feinstein attempted to include an amendment to the bill that would increase the penalties on crimes against pregnant women. We're joined by Silvia Enriquez of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Why did so many conservatives vote against this amendment?
We believe that this is a strategy on the part of the anti-choice movement in another attempt to undermine the right of every woman to make decisions about her own body. We believe that there's a lot of conservative forces and anti-women people that really want to take the self-determination away of every woman and to take away our reproductive justice and rights.
The bill essentially grants personhood to a fetus. Talk about the repercussions that this bill will have in terms of protecting reproductive rights.
It's another clear indication of the erosion, and we once always used to say that it was a slow eroding process. However, now we see how quickly our rights are being taken away and undermined.
And 29 states already have existing unborn victims laws. Why did legislators feel that it was necessary to pass a similar law federally?
We feel that people really do not have the interest, the main interest of the woman or the woman's health, or really the interest of the family as a whole, because we know that women are the core of every family and every community in the U.S., and that the fact that women are not able to make these decisions upon their own is really just another way that families won't be taken care of and women will not be able to have the rights that have been granted to us.
Sylvia, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Again, that was Sylvia Enriquez of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. The United Nations failed to adopt a resolution yesterday that would have condemned the assassination of Hamas spiritual leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. The resolution was sponsored by Algeria and Libya and supported by 11 other countries, yet the United States was the sole vote against it. Germany, Romania, and the UK abstained. But, as FSRN correspondent Ola Farawati reports, many in the Arab world say that the targeted killing of Yassin has provided the movement with even more ammunition.
Directly following the targeted assassination of Hamas spiritual leader Sheikh Yassin by Israel on Monday, Hezbollah claimed responsibility for firing at Israeli troops, which Lebanese police report was followed by Israeli warplane raids on the outskirts of Kfar Shuppa. On Wednesday, some 400 Jordanian trade unionists and opposition supporters held a sit-in in central Amman. Israel's assassination of Sheikh Yassin could end up drawing a wave of new recruits to the Islamic militant movement and broadening its hardline appeal. Jordanian political analyst Ghassan Mammar.
Israel's move will have a detrimental effect. The feelings of the Arabs and Palestinians have been inflamed in a way that Israel itself has not predicted. The assassination of Yassin is a challenge to the Palestinians' patriotic feelings. The Arab and Palestinian streets have been mobilized on both the militant and the political fronts.
Thousands of Arabs in several countries for the second day on Wednesday protested against the assassination. In Egypt, hundreds gathered in Cairo at two universities, as well as the Lawyers and Journalists Union offices. There, protesters called on Arabs to boycott American products. And in Libya, some 5,000 demonstrators rallied in the Libyan capital. This surge of sympathy among even moderate Arabs and Palestinians will give popular legitimacy to Hamas's fight against the occupying powers. Hashem al-Faris is a Palestinian Jordanian whose family was evicted during Israel's 1967 invasion of the West Bank.
They think that they have killed the movement. They are mistaken. I was one of the believers in peace with Israel, but they clearly don't want peace with us, and all is left for Palestinians now is bloody resistance.
Jordan and Egypt are the only Arab countries to have signed peace treaties with Israel. Many have denounced the killing of Sheikh Yassin, but the main voice has been condemnation for the inaction of Arab governments. Fawzi Samhouri is president of the Jordanian Society for Human Rights. Samhouri believes it's time that the international community holds Israel and the United States accountable.
Israel has invaded Palestinian land, a land that does not belong to Israelis. This has been recognized internationally, and Israel remains the only country that defies international legitimacy and continues to infringe on Palestinian human rights.
Despite public condemnation of the killing of Sheikh Yassin by National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, many Jordanians know the political and financial ties between Washington and Tel Aviv.
We can see clearly that the U.S. approves of all this. This is part of expansionary plans by Israel, no matter how the U.S. hides it. We can see that they want and support all of this.
Arab leaders are scheduled to discuss the matter at their Tunis summit next Monday. In Amman, Jordan, I am Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
On Tuesday, the U.S. military released 272 detainees from Abu Ghraib prison, once Saddam Hussein's most notorious lockup. In a carefully choreographed event, the prisoners were brought out in groups from inside the prison. Reporters taken by the military to witness the event were not allowed to interview the men being released. 2 days later, FSRN's Aaron Glantz returned to Abu Ghraib and found hundreds of families waiting outside for a chance to see their loved ones.
155, noontime, and dozens of families have gathered outside Abu Ghraib prison, seeking a chance to get an appointment to see their loved ones. They gather around the razor wire that surrounds the prison. Each holds a scrap of paper with a number. If their number is called, they are allowed to go inside. Ali Ahmed's brother is among those incarcerated here. He's a farmer from the village Khalas, picked up in an American raid for resistance fighters last December.
They gave me an appointment to see my brother for July 31st. By then, I will have spent 8 months without seeing him, and they're saying they will give us back Iraq at the end of June. And they gave me an appointment at the end of July. What is this?
Among the more than 10,000 Iraqis jailed in Abu Ghraib is Hussein Ali Ahmed's brother and his brother's wife. Hussein's brother was arrested for taking part in the resistance. His brother's wife is incarcerated for raising money to support attacks on the occupying army. Both of them are held in open-air tents inside Abu Ghraib's walls. The prison, built to hold political prisoners under Saddam's regime, is too small to hold all those arrested by the American army.
There are no terrorists in Iraq. If I defend my country, I can't be a terrorist. Why did they come here in the first place? That's what made me a terrorist.
A slight man sits next to the barbed wire, waiting for his turn. This is the second time he's had an appointment to see his brother. The first time he came to the prison with an attorney and was told lawyers were barred from the prison. So this time he came by himself. Today he came to the prison dressed in his work clothes, the blue and gold uniform of Airness, the multinational security firm contracted by Halliburton to guard Iraq's oil infrastructure.
I had no work. I don't like Americans particularly. I stopped them on the street once and told them I didn't like them. But you know, I have 4 kids, live in a rented house, and my brother is in prison. What else can I do?
American soldiers serving as prison guards at Abu Ghraib refused to comment for this story, saying the only officers authorized to comment were at an American military base called Camp Victory, formerly Saddam Hussein International Airport. Senior officers there were unavailable. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
Here is journalist and Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row.
Sometimes it is simply amazing to listen to Americans when they call onto talk shows and voice their opinions. The one-dimensional, narrow thinking and xenophobia is often quite stunning. If one listens to such shows, one hears the following thoughts being expressed. You know, those Spaniards are just a bunch of cowards. Know what I mean? They let a bunch of terrorists push them out of the coalition. Hey, them damn socialists are just doing the same thing that Chamberlain did to Hitler. It's the same thing. It's appeasement. Or, those Spanish over there, they should know that they're just letting the terrorists win. They need to stick with our president.
The recent electoral win of the Socialist Party over the Popular Party's resigning Prime Minister José María Aznar has sent American nationalists into conniption fits and into a tizzy of verbal assaults against the Spanish people. Most accept, almost uncritically, that the recent election returns were based almost solely on the Madrid bombings. They've presumably forgotten, or chosen to forget, that the Spanish had among the highest opposition levels to the Iraq War, nearly 90%. Few sane political parties that wanted to stay in power would have dared to oppose 90% of their populace on anything. The socialists simply utilized basic political ideas to appeal to the greatest number of Spaniards on a burning issue of the day, the war in Iraq. The first public comments by the newly elected Spanish leader, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, made his position quite clear, quote, "The war has been a disaster. The occupation continues to be a great disaster," unquote. Prime Minister-elect Zapatero announced that his party will keep a key campaign promise to remove 1,300 Spanish soldiers from Iraq. The administration is not pleased. Of the Iraq war, Zapatero said, it hasn't generated anything but more violence and hate. In Iraq, meanwhile, the shattered state, with its puppets of an alleged governing council, which can be overruled at the slightest whim of Paul Bremer, the U.S. overlord, has as its highest and only credential that they are acceptable to the United States. Iraq stands on the brink of civil war. And now, unless things change drastically, the Zapatero government has pledged to pull out all Spanish troops, the fracturing of the so-called coalition. The American presence in Iraq, founded on the quicksand of false pretenses, can only be seen as the occupation that it is. It cannot be the midwife of a democracy that is in tatters in America itself. How can America claim to be waging a war to install democracy when it openly opposes the democracy of its so-called allies? When the Spanish people said overwhelmingly in the streets of Spain, in their millions, that they opposed the war, and when polls showed upwards to 90% of them opposed to the American adventure in Iraq, what is vaguely democratic about the Spanish Prime Minister, Aznar, sending 1,300 Spaniards to support such an action? Whatever happened to let the people decide? This war, its relentless push from the defense industries and the oil cartels, was not done to defend democracy, but to cripple it. In its train have come the stifling of domestic dissent, the silencing of critics, the growing state repression against opponents, and a press that has been remarkable only in its craven servility to their corporate and political masters. Undemocratically selected, Bush has ruled like a prince of the blood, an autocrat born to send thousands of lesser beings to their deaths to ensure the domination of his class. He is repulsed by the very notion of democracy and regards Congress as little more than a mild annoyance. Meanwhile, the Spaniards are practicing democracy in a form far purer than anything we have seen in years in America. We have little to teach and much to learn from them. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This week, West and Central African ministers have gathered in Dakar to see into developing strategies for more potable water and better sanitation. With the help of the Food and Agriculture Organization, several specialists have also come together to protect the ever-reducing forest resources. In Senegal, Indiaga Sek reports.
The third ministerial session of the Regional Center for Potable Water and Purification, or CREPA, has been held in Dakar to tackle challenges of providing drinking water to urban and rural populations. In sub-Saharan Africa, more than 1 million people die each year of easily preventable waterborne diseases. Habib Sy, Senegal's Minister of Hydraulic, says high-quality training is important.
La mission principale assignée à l'institution.
The institution's main mission is to help the most vulnerable populations to find sustainable solutions to their problems of potable water, hygiene, and sanitation. CREPA is training water technicians and has organized workshops on suitable technologies for water professionals.
Currently, some 1.2 billion people lack access to clean water around the world, and more than double have no access to proper sanitation. In sub-Saharan Africa, populations walk long distances to fetch water in unsecured wells in rural areas. In urban areas, most water points are polluted. Senegal has invested some $25 million to build a 60-mile water main from Lake Gier to supply water to several cities. The project Water in the Long Term has been initiated in partnership with Brazil and France. Next August, 65,000 cubic meters per day will be pumped to provide drinking water to the main cities and villages. The main objective of the project is to secure a vast water supply for Senegal's capital, Dakar, till 2015. Mamadou Samb, director of Senegalese Society of Water Distribution, SONES, says they will ensure water for all.
Il s'agit de compléter l'alimentation en eau de Dakar et de renforcer l'alimentation.
It's all about ensuring a water supply in Dakar and reinforcing water distribution along the main. So I think that this is a major part of the water project in the long term. And our organization, SONES, is invited to beat all records. We will ensure water security in Dakar and most urban centers along the water main.
West African countries bordering the Sahara Desert receive 100 to 1,500 millimeters of water per year. The shortage has triggered long periods of drought, causing wetlands and riverbeds to dry out. The amount of salt has also increased, affecting farming and forests. With the help of the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, specialists from Cape Verde, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry, Mali and Senegal met in Dakar last week to discuss protection of 1,800,000 square kilometers of forest resources. In response, Water and Forestry Commissioners have set up plans to stop over-exploitation and wood trafficking between countries. Mamadou Diagne Fada, Senegalese Minister for Environment, says FAO has allowed them to fulfill the environment section of the new Partnership for Africa's Development, or NEPAD.
La FAO vient encore une fois de plus.
The Food and Agriculture Organization has once again created a support framework to implement two major environmental acts of NEPAD. This is about partnership and solidarity and the choice and application of sustainable forestry rules.
Recent failures by the International Monetary Fund to aid Africa in obtaining drinkable water has caused ammunition amongst African organizations who are expected to confront the policies of the IMF and World Bank during their annual meeting later this month in Washington, D.C. For Free Speech Radio News in Dakar, Senegal, I am Diaga Sek.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.